This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, filling in for April Baer. With parents scrambling to make plans for their kids this school year, there are folks working on strategies to help students, parents, and communities thrive during this time. Tashmika Torok is executive director of the Firecracker Foundation in Lansing, which works to support children who are victims of sexual violence. In her work on community-wide efforts at protecting children, Tashmika has put together a roadmap for establishing child care collectives for the coming school year. And she joins us now. Tashmika, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So parents, for months now, have been often on their own scrambling to try and figure out how to balance their child's learning with their own work responsibilities. And you heard a lot of frustration from parents about there being more focus on opening bars and restaurants than figuring out how to open schools safely. Why do you think that there was that lack of focus early on, even as parents were saying, this what is happening right now is just not sustainable?
I think that we have society that has decided that children and families are not critical or necessary in terms of productivity. And we essentially have a country that doesn't provide basic leaves for families. Childcare expenses are not thought about when we're thinking about employing people. And so I think it's really easy for our country to have that be on the back burner. And we've also had a situation for a long time where we've been able to trust that our public schools are going to be able to hold children for us when they reach a certain age in terms of the school year. Of course, we're always scrambling in the summer to determine, like, who are going to watch these kids while we're at work in the summer or on holiday breaks. But for most of the year, we could trust that kids would be in school. And so the fact that we did not have a safety net for kids is a part of that ongoing struggle for families and children to be cared for by the institutions, whether that be federal government, state government, or even just the companies that we work for.
When did you start to have that looming dread, that sense that our society was going to be woefully ill-prepared to open schools in a way that was safe and considerate of the pandemic?
Immediately. The work that I do is working with children who've experienced sexual violence. And so I'm very aware of the many ways that community fails children on a regular basis. I knew that the rates of child abuse were going to go up because children are not given access in this moment to safe spaces outside of their home. And most of the abuse that children experience is in their home. 40% or better of the reports of child abuse come from educators. So immediately I started thinking about what do we need in this moment to make sure that kids are safe and cared for, because I knew that the structures that we have in place, not only were they not coming, but they didn't have the capacity. Our schools have been underfunded for so long that I think it would be really naive of us to think that they could stretch even further during a global pandemic to meet the very specialized needs of so many kids in our many, many communities.
Tashmika, everything you just talked about, then the gravity of everything that we know and that of which we don't know, is serving to bolster an argument that is made by many parents in many circles that school should be open and that the risks that are posed to vulnerable children of all kinds. These are the reasons that schools should be open, because the dangers faced by them are much greater than the threat of the spread of COVID-19 among children that we know, especially younger children that we know of so far. Do you think that schools should be open?
I do not think schools should be open. And I don't say that lightly. What I think what's important to acknowledge is that everything that I just said was happening pre-COVID, except for the not having access to the safe spaces. So children have been experiencing this kind of violence in their homes, I mean, forever. Right. And so what I'm actually making the case for is more of a transformation about the way that we practice community and safety for children that extends above and beyond the institutions that are under-resourced. We as a community have a responsibility to the children in our lives above and beyond what schools can do. So that what I've been really encouraging people to do in this moment is think about themselves as actors in prevention. So teachers have historically been those trusted people, but if there are not schools, then who are the people in your lives that your children trust, that have access to them? What kinds of conversations are we having with our kids about who has access to their bodies? And digitally, because we also know that sexual violence happens digitally, and right now there's a lot of digital access to our kids. We have an opportunity to think about preventing violence in a community-based way that we have not had before. It's one of those things where we're having to strike this balance where, yes, do I wish schools could function? Absolutely. But I don't think it's safe to do that. We also don't want kids to get sick and die, and we don't want other people to get sick and die. So I think the answer is more in building the kinds of relationships that we need to help kids be safe in their own homes.
If we're talking about a parent or community-led support system, essentially, that can help some of the most vulnerable kids and kids who are not so vulnerable, if it's parent-led and a lot of abusive behavior is happening in homes, how can we create a natural intimacy between a child and an adult that isn't a teacher, that isn't a parent or a relative, that the child would have enough access to other adults and community members that would be able to weed out what might be an abusive relationship that's happening at home?
I think first, a lot of people need to understand the dynamics of abuse so that they can be a safe and healthy adult to be in relationship with kids. I think we also have to understand that people who are being abusive are going to use the same tactics that they would if kids were going to school. So in my life with my kids, you know, we have friends who live in our neighborhood who we have conversations with about what it means to be safe, to have a safe and healthy relationship with our kids. Where are the boundaries? Our kids know what those boundaries are. And I think that it requires a level of intimacy that we're all experiencing right now anyway. We're learning to check in on our neighbors in a new way. We're learning to provide for people that we wouldn't typically be providing for pre-COVID. And so this is just an extension of that. I've encouraged people to know who their neighbors are. I've encouraged people to, you know, offer socially distanced story time, offer to help with providing childcare in a safe way. And there is no perfect way for me to say, like, no child is going to experience abuse if you just do these five things. But I can say that what happens for kids who experience abuse when they know that there are people who see them, value them, and love them is that they are more resilient and more likely to disclose when abuse is happening.
I'm speaking now with Tashmika Torok. She's executive director of the Firecracker Foundation based in Lansing, Michigan. They put together a toolkit for communities looking to put together childcare collectives and community-based response to schools being closed amid the spread of COVID. Tashmika, let's talk about learning pods that we have heard reported out in the news, but also many of us firsthand experience watching parents speaking on social media about how they're going to pod up or strategies for doing that. I think one of the great concerns among those who are discussing the idea of pods or collectives, whether they're actively trying to be a part of them or are worried about them from the outside, there is an idea that it would deepen educational inequities that already exist. How can communities avoid that?
I don't know that communities can avoid that, to be honest with you. And it's not our community's fault that that exists. The social inequities are caused by white supremacy, and we are going to have to work really hard as communities to be thinking about those children who we have a relationship with to bridge that gap. But I think that placing that burden on the shoulders of families who are trying to keep their kids safe while educating them during a global pandemic is really unfair. And if we want to talk about causing more inequities, if we tear down the things that families are trying to build for themselves right now because they are not better than a well-funded educational institution, then that will also cause inequities in education. So I think that what we need more than anything is for people to resource the youth in our community. And so where there are gaps in technology, where there are gaps in economical advantages, right? Like, or we have families who can work remotely, but we have families who can't. I think that it's going to require people who have more to give more and people who don't have as much to ask for help. And we're going to have to do that in community.
When you say have more, give more, what does that look like to you? Do you mean give more of themselves philanthropically through nonprofits, or give more of themselves in the absolutely tangible sense of reaching out to neighbors, friends, et cetera, to make sure that people are taken care of? What does that look like to you?
I think it can look like any one of those things. But when we're specifically talking about children, I can think about, again, my family. So I have children who are all above the age of 12. They can pretty much do a lot of the educational things independently with support. I can work remotely. My schedule is flexible. And my husband co-parents and is also self-employed. So he makes his own schedule. So when I'm looking at the people who we are building with, I'm thinking, okay, we have a little more in terms of our scheduling flexibility than maybe someone who has to go to work between the hours of 9 to 5. So mm-hmm. maybe that means they would take on doing an evening activity with our kids so that I can attend a meeting in the evening, but I can take on more of what's happening during the day. You know, when we talk about childcare collectives, the first place that you start is in relationship and is figuring out what your priorities are for your kids. And right now, for some families, the priority may not be to keep up educationally. Honestly, the priority might be just that they can go to work and that their kids will be held in safety. There's a lot of things that we have to work out that are going to have to happen in relationship between the adults. I think that's what I mean more about, like, who gives more and who, you know, like, mm-hmm. and who is taking on different roles within a collective. And the thing that's really challenging is we haven't ever had to do this before.
Right. So that's what I was going to ask you is, when I'm thinking about childcare collectives or learning pods with families siphoning off their resources and their children to sort of create this, I don't know, quarantine mega bubble, if you will, it strikes me that we are talking about trying to create hundreds of school systems within a school system, and some of these small pod school systems will fail and some of them will succeed, just as that's true with schools themselves. But we're trying to create entire systems within just, you know, a six-week time frame, and that seems impossible in my estimation. But do you see it that way as well, or is it completely different to you?
Well, I also don't think it's all or nothing. I think if you are thinking that we are building a school overnight, absolutely nobody is going to be able to do that. But if we're thinking about, okay, my kids have to be in school online during the day while I am working, and I need someone to help them do their math between the hours of 1 and 2, that doesn't seem so insurmountable. I mean, first of all, childcare collectives are not new. So there's something called the Intergalactic Conspiracy of Childcare Collectives. There was a session at the Allied Media Conference where all of these collectives from across the country came together to share what their experiences are, to learn. And the goal of a childcare collective was to make sure that parents had access to social justice movements. Other people built childcare collectives for homeschooling, for example. Homeschool families have been parts of collectives and have built collectives for years. So it's not really insurmountable. It's just that we've never had to do it before. And I think another thing that's important to name is that families should not be doing this work solely. So when I say a childcare collective, I'm also talking about non-parenting people. Children are a part of this community, and they deserve to be safe and held just like everybody else. And so how can we as a community step up to the plate and make sure that that's happening?
Tashmika, before we go, we've heard from a lot of educators, people who are paying attention to our educational systems, who are optimistic, and I think more hopeful than anything, that this moment could serve as a realigning of priorities within our education system and also a reformation of what education looks like and how it's provided to kids. Do you value this moment as being that opportunity as well?
I do. You know, it's like anything else in the world. There are a lot of things that I'm not grateful for in this moment, but I do think that we have known that children, like 19% of high school graduates, don't know how to read. How is that possible?
Right.
You know, we know that children can't get food if they don't go to school. How have we allowed that to become possible? And again, when we go back to thinking about just safety and child abuse, like, we do have an opportunity to rethink how we are engaging with children and families and what role we have. I think it's also important to name that employers, people who have power, your managers, your boss, how are we as leaders taking this opportunity to support the people who work for us that also have children? Because a lot of these things are dependent on the community, and people who are in leadership are a part of that community and can make or break the way that families are able to function right now. And so I think that's another thing that really needs to be lifted up, is that not all power is in the hands of every parent. And we need community members, whether those are leaders or people who don't have children but have access to resources, to come alongside us and support us so that we all make it out of this and no one is left behind.
Tashmika Torok is executive director of the Firecracker Foundation based in Lansing, Michigan. They have put together a toolkit for communities looking to put together childcare collectives and moving more towards a cooperative school year that we're facing. Tashmika, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on this.
Thank you so much. And I just want to name again, I'm really thankful for all of the work that national collectives have done to really guide us in this moment. I think it's going to be key to have that legacy for us to follow. So thank you for taking the time to talk to me about it.